The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to John. Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out from Nazareth?" Philip said, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." The Gospel of our Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Christ. Please be seated. So, pop quiz. Does anyone know who wrote the piece that we just sang before Betty's reading of the gospel, "The Word is Near You"? Who wrote it? Bob Reed wrote that piece. Bob's written a number of other pieces that some are familiar with, now contained in a work called The Bristlecone Mass. And it is a fabulous thing. We did it. How long ago was that, Bob? How long ago was that, Bob? 25 years ago. No. 2011. 6 years ago. Yeah. Production at the Brewery Arts Center. It was just so much. It was a ton of work. But it sure was a lot of fun. And at the time, I believe the staff at Brewery Arts said it was the largest attendance they'd had on a 2-day run ever up until that time. And so it was pretty amazing. Yeah, both days were packed at Brewery Arts. So anyway, just like to point that out to folks. And we use Bob's music off and on over the course of the year as part of our 10 o'clock worship. So he's been a great contributor to our common life. So, with his permission, yes, always with permission in these litigious days. Jesus has a vision, and he shares it with Nathanael. Nathanael's all blown away, and Nathanael's looking for a spiritual experience. In fact, all of the characters in the first four chapters of the Gospel according to John are on what we would call and what our native brothers and sisters would refer to as vision quests. They're all looking for a vision. And as we heard Virginia share with us from the story of Samuel, it was the author tells us that people weren't having visions in those days. And I want to suggest that probably lots of people were having visions, but they weren't sharing them. And there's a difference. And we'll get back to that in a second. Because Samuel is born into a time of spiritual desolation, religious corruption, political danger, social upheaval. Ringing any bells here, folks? You sound familiar to you? It ought to. And Jesus, some hundreds of years later, is born into a similar kind of setting. We've talked about this. It's a war zone, as the Middle East has been for centuries, but now on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, Imperial Rome is making its mark and destroying people's lives in order to establish what they call the peace of Rome. And on it goes. And so here you've got Samuel born into this time of desolation. Even Eli, who is the priest of the temple and the tabernacle, he's been disconnected. His family's getting all crazy. They're selling off the goods of the tabernacle to make a little extra. I mean, you know how it goes. You know, if you can't make a good living, then just don't get caught. And so Eli is cut off. But then finally, three times the charm, he realizes what's going on with Samuel, who as a young kid is clueless. And Samuel says, you know what, next time, that just say, here I am, for your servant is listening. And from that moment on, the young Samuel is in for what I like to refer to as Mr. Toad's wild ride. In the book of Samuel. I mean, it goes from bad to worse to worser, if there is such a word, and then it gets a little bit good, and then it gets weird, and then it gets worse again. I mean, just up and down and up and down. And this born in an age of conflict, and Samuel becomes one of the voices of God, a prophet. And then again in the Gospel of John that we heard a little bit of from Betty, the story begins, known otherwise as the prologue of John's Gospel. You know, in the beginning was the logion, is the Greek word, or what is translated into English, the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all this kind of stuff. And as it unfolds, and then it sort of segues a little piece about John in the wilderness, and then it unfolds a little bit more, and there's Jesus, and we begin to hear and see these connections. And in effect, what's happening is that the Gospel according to John opens with a description of mystical union. And the union, the mystical union, includes God, Jesus, eventually down the road a piece in John's Gospel, this thing that's referred to as Parakletos. Good luck translating that. We usually translate it Holy Spirit. Doesn't even come close to the nuance of John's Gospel, but we'll leave it at that. It also includes anyone who chooses to follow Jesus, and eventually what we discover in the Gospel according to John is that this mystical union involves and includes all of humanity, all of creation, and the entire universe. Did I leave anything out? I don't think so. It's an amazing Gospel, a little bit different story than found in the other three, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, where Jesus sort of comes on the scene and he's kind of declared, or he's pronounced, oh look. And in the Gospel according to John, here's Jesus described as part of the center of this mystical union of which we all partake. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the next four chapters, all these people come along looking for a vision, you know, looking for that connection. Some are successful and some are not. And it seems, oddly enough, that as John's Gospel unfolds, those who manage eventually to make that connection sort of drop into their bodies, and those who aren't so successful coming to grips with the nature of this mystical union stay stuck in their heads. So, we got to ask the question, where are we? You know, are we still stuck in our heads trying to figure it all out? And if you want some examples of that, just keep reading John's Gospel. It's a great conversation between Jesus and a guy named Nicodemus, who gets stuck in his head. It'll give you a great example of what that looks like. I suspect all of us are familiar with what it's like to be stuck in our heads. Anybody unfamiliar with that experience? Okay, I didn't think so. Everybody's kind of got that one. And so the invitation then of the gospel today, and really of the scriptures, is to give ourselves permission to start dropping out of our heads and back into our bodies, and to stop looking for the enemy and start looking in the mirror to discover where God resides. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of what it might look like to stop looking for the enemy. We spend an awful lot of time, I certainly have, looking for the enemy. Here's one example of that. This from Eduardo Galeano's wonderful book of meditations, daily meditations, called The Children of Days. It's a great piece if you haven't come across it. This one actually popped up today, January 14th, called The Haitian Curse. The earthquake in Haiti was the culminating tragedy of a country without shade, without water, devastated by imperial greed and the war against slavery. The dethroned slavers explain it in another way. Voodoo was to blame. Voodoo is to blame for all the country's misfortunes. Voodoo doesn't deserve the name religion. It is nothing but African superstition, black magic, a black obsession, the devil's thing. The Roman Catholic Church, which has no shortage of faithful believers willing to sell the fingernails of saints or feathers from the wings of the Archangel Gabriel, got Haiti to outlaw voodoo in 1845, 1860, 1896, 1915, and 1942. And make no mistake, every religious tradition has a version of this, even among Anglicans. We've had our version of witch-burning things going on. In recent times, evangelical groups took up the battle against superstition. They come from the country of Pat Robertson, a country that has no 13th floor in its skyscrapers, no row 13 in its airplanes, where civilized Christians who believe God created the world in 7 days are the majority. You see what I mean by looking for the enemy? That's one example. Another example, let me just pull it up on here, see if I can get it. I think I've shared with you folks that I use Eduardo's wonderful book for daily meditation. Also, another fabulous resource called Courage to Change. It comes out of the Al-Anon program, and lo and behold, today's meditation, talking about people who are trying to get the alcoholic to stop drinking. Anybody have any experience with that here? We're going to figure out a way to make them stop drinking. Or at the very least, to drink like normal people. And in today's meditation, it says, "In time I understood this. By letting go of this battle we are sure to lose, we become free. There comes a time when we have to stop looking for the enemy and start looking in a mirror. The other day, I was graced with a phone call from a gentleman named White Wolf Switzer. Now, for anyone who's been around St. Peter's for 30 years or more, you would remember Bernie and Gladys Switzer, this wonderful elderly couple. When I came to St. Peter's, they were among what I like to refer to as our munchkins. Bernie and Gladys were about this tall, kind of like Frank and Joan Papiani, you know. They're part of the munchkin group here at St. Peter's, just gentle folk. Both of them were involved in scouting. They had two kids, a son and a daughter. The daughter has since passed away. Both Bernie and Gladys passed away years and years ago. And after Bernie died, their son, who's given Christian name I can't even remember, because through his experience of scouting, he came to claim his native roots. They had some native blood in them. And White Wolf got heavily involved with the tribes here in northern Nevada. He now lives in California. Just a wonderful guy. He's in his late 70s now, and he called the other day. And I just love speaking with him, because within about 30 seconds of, hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, what's up? Hey, what's up? We begin to speak of things spiritual. And he starts telling me about the vision quest that he's been involved in, and the folks that he's working with, and the sweats that he's done. And in fact, when Bernie, his dad, finally died, we arranged a sweat lodge up on the beach at Galilee and did a sweat up there. It was just amazing. And White Wolf has been this kind of anchor for me. We don't talk often. Every couple, 3 years maybe, he'll just call out of the blue. But our conversation the other day reminded me that in ancient times and among our indigenous peoples, there's never been any question that the physical realm has always been imbued and infused with the world of spirit. We talked about this last Sunday, and we're going to talk about it some more as time goes on. And in biblical times, in ancient times, there was never any question. I mean, any of the characters, you know, the coming of Jesus, the Hebrew scriptures, that the world of spirit and the physical realm are intertwined. And we have managed these last, 300, 400 years to both pull them apart and then completely ignore the world of spirit, to our great peril. And today's gospel and today's readings from the book of Samuel give us a great example of what the world looks like when the world of spirit and the physical realm are pulled apart and the world of spirit is ignored. It looks like that scene in Samuel, and it may look somewhat like our lives as well. And then we have this example of what it can look like when those two are allowed to commingle and converge all the time, because that's apparently how the universe has been, you know, made and held together by the divine. And so all around us, we have examples of folks who get that connection. White Wolf has been, for me, the latest example of that. And one of the things he said over the course of our conversation, and because he was raised a good Episcopal boy, and he's still very familiar with the Episcopal tradition, but now having claimed his native roots, he said, we don't look for the enemy anymore. All we look for is prayer people.
And I went, whoa.
Prayer people, people who pray. We don't care how, we don't care to what or whom, just do they pray? Because prayer can open us up to the connection between the physical realm and the world of spirit. As can all the various spiritual experiences or mystical experiences that you and I have had over the years that probably on some level we've managed to completely ignore. I think last Sunday I asked, so I'm going to ask again, how many folks here have had a spiritual experience or a mystical experience of any kind whatsoever? Okay, a lot. When's the last time you shared that experience with anybody? Or when's the last time you asked about what that experience might have meant? Because it's not always clear, is it? And we think on some level, well, maybe there's something a little off about me, or maybe there's something a little weird about me, or maybe I just made that up, or, you know, lost my nut for a minute. Or those of us who have the spiritual experiences of a learning variety where we have days where we say, nah, there's no connection. I'm all on my own. To be a people who will give ourselves permission to share those experiences in order to claim them, not necessarily understand them, because again, as soon as we start trying to understand them, we're climbing back out of our bodies and back into our heads, which we've been stuck in for way too long. Time to be going in the other direction. But to just embrace those experiences and allow them to inform us in such a way that makes it possible for us to be reminded on a regular basis that the physical realm and the world of spirit are together. It's all of a piece. And when we begin to recognize that connection on a regular basis, perhaps a daily basis, we will begin to see some other things that the ancient ones saw all the time as well. That, for instance, the desert is alive, that the mountains are alive, that the lakes and the rivers are alive, that the trees are alive. Well, you knew that part. That the landscape is alive, that the world, the planet on which we live, is a living thing. And as we embrace that and are reminded of it on a regular basis, we can then allow it to affect the decisions that we make about how we're going to live. I mean, if we knew that the earth was a living thing, we might decide to treat it a little differently, might we not? So, when we encounter the gospel according to John and that whole wonderful beginning of it, the mystical union, and then all these people who are on these vision quests, over and over again, the phrase that keeps popping up in John's gospel is, come and see. Come and see. Come and see the connection between the physical realm and the world of spirit. Come and see and witness both your own spiritual experiences, your mystical experiences, and the ones that others might share with us. Come and see that all things are connected, that the earth is a living thing, and that we're in this together. Come and see. and allow our eyes to refocus on a daily basis, where we stop looking for the enemy and start looking in a mirror. Take a moment. Take a nice deep breath. Take another deep breath. Don't forget to let it out.